And next, we can finally tell you that there is a way to get something for nothing. Say something happens in your backyard that needs attention, and without lifting a finger, without even noticing, mysteriously, it's taken care of for free. NPR science correspondent Robert Krulwich has the details.
It begins with a, kind of a thwack against your kitchen window or the wall of your house. So you step outside, and there, lying in the grass, is a little bird. And when you lean over and you look closely, you see it's dead. So you look away. And then maybe a day, 2 days later, you pass by that very spot on your lawn, and the corpse is gone.
Mm-hmm.
Totally gone.
Yeah.
And you didn't move it. So where did it go? Well, one possibility, says Professor Bernd Heinrich at the University of Vermont, is you have just received the services of a very remarkable pair of beetles.
Well, they are burying beetles. They are the undertakers of the small animals in the forest, the little birds and mice, rodents.
So if I'm a bird lying dead on a lawn, they would know that I'm there?
Yeah, very shortly. After you die, you're going to emit some scent that they can smell apparently for miles.
And because natural recycling is a very competitive business,
they have to get there before the flies can get it, before a raccoon or crow or raven picks it up. So they work very fast.
And these flying beetles are big are they?
You know, as big as a big bumblebee.
Which is not very big if you're trying to hoist a dead starling or a dead mouse on your back and lug it off to soft ground. But when these beetles, and it's a family business, it's a mom-and-pop kind of arrangement, when they get you where they want you, they start to dig.
They bury you. They start digging underneath you, removing the dirt and throwing it to the sides until gradually you start to sink down.
So how long does it take them to bury a whole bird?
You know, in a night, and you're buried totally.
Then, says Professor Heinrich, in a kind of, I'm not quite sure how to put this, in a sort of happy moment, the two beetles will mate,
yeah,
which produces beetle babies safely underground.
And they build a little nest for the larvae.
Mm-hmm. And then the parents munch on the bird or on the mouse, and they chew the food on behalf of their children.
The young actually beg. They are sort of analogous to birds, to a pair of birds feeding their young.
And after a few days, those babies mature, and they become flying beetles, and they take off refueled with bits of mouse or bird, and they rejoin the neighborhood.
Yes, yes.
And it's just this kind of finish, says Professor Heinrich, dying and then being scattered up and about everywhere that he wants when he dies. No tight coffin for me, he says.
You know, being sealed up, totally removed from all the natural processes that normally occur with every animal on Earth is very somehow frightening. It seems unnatural.
But I think, don't most people find that being eaten is the thing that's frightening? And a little, I don't want to get eaten by a beetle.
No, I don't find that frightening at all. I find that comforting to be part of the ecosystem.
And he's not alone. There's an old Lee Hayes song sung by the great Pete Seeger.
If I should die before I wake, all my bone and sinew take, put me in the compost pile, decompose me for a while.
You laugh, but, you know, there are a lot of people who hate the idea of being decomposed. So,
well, yeah, I don't think it's decompose that's the emphasis here. It's the grow and the compose, to be composed into grass, to be composed into ravens, to be composed into flowers and trees. You know, that's a comforting thought to me.
But it's not like you're looking forward to the idea, though.
Well, I don't really relish being eaten, anything like that. I think it's just part of the cost and giving back. I realize I have killed untold hundreds of thousands to live. All of us have. Because we all live off other life. And just to remove ourselves totally so that nobody else can feed on us, just somehow it seems sacrilegious to me.
All that I am will feed the trees and little fishies in the seas. When radishes and corn you munch, you may be having me for lunch.
But when you choose to be buried in a tight coffin, says Professor Heinrich, you do lock yourself off from the trees and the animals that you know and the critters that you've lived with.
Worms, water, sun will have their way.
Why not share yourself with the world that you know, he asks.
I find that comforting to be part of the ecosystem.
And then excrete me with a grin, chortling, there goes Lee again.
It's not everybody's way to get buried, but it is
right.
One way. Robert Krulwich, NPR News.
And if all this has you thinking about other burial ideas, Robert Krulwich has an even wilder one for you, the freeze, shatter, and sprinkle option. You can hear about that and other fascinating human and animal rituals at NPR.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Good morning. Here is one of the developing stories we will be following this morning. The latest winner of the Nobel Peace Prize is President Barack Obama. The Nobel Committee awarded the honor to the new president for his efforts to reduce the world's stockpile of nuclear weapons. He also gets credit for working for world peace. This has happened in the last few minutes, and we'll hear a great deal about this development throughout the morning.
It is not clear what effect, if any, that honor may have on the president's domestic agenda. The president's allies are still working to get a health care bill through a key Senate committee. And you could think of that bill like a giant brick house. Having built it, lawmakers are pulling out a few bricks here, a few bricks there, hoping to save some money, and hoping the whole thing doesn't collapse. NPR's Julie Robner reports.
The good news for the Finance Committee is that the overall cost of the bill, according to the CBO, is $829 billion over 10 years. That's well under the $900 billion limit set by President Obama. But the committee had to scramble to keep its bill under that total. It would require that everyone have insurance, a so-called individual mandate, but there was only enough money to help the poor and lower middle class who don't already have insurance pay for their new coverage. That lack of help for more solidly middle-class families, in turn, made a lot of senators, like Maine Republican Olympia Snow, squeamish about imposing financial penalties on those who didn't or couldn't buy coverage.
I think until we have been able to demonstrate that we have accomplished the goal of achieving the level of affordability for average Americans, that we should withhold the idea of penalties. One thing to suggest an individual mandate is quite another on the penalty.
So as one of its last changes, the committee voted to eliminate financial penalties for those who failed to buy required insurance for the first year the bill would be in effect. The amendment also lowered subsequent penalties and phased them in more slowly over several years. That move may give politicians some protection, but it could end up backfiring in a big way, says the health insurance industry.
Having a mandate with no penalties is not a requirement. It's an aspirational goal.
Alisa Fox is a senior vice president with the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
You need everybody in the insurance pool to make sure that premiums are affordable. And lowering the penalty will mean that people will find it more advantageous to pay a very small penalty than buy insurance.
Particularly young, healthy people who are most likely to be uninsured and most likely to prefer to pay a penalty of a few hundred dollars a year rather than buy health insurance that could cost several thousand. So if those young, healthy people sit out, premiums go up for everyone else. And it's not just the health insurance industry that says making the penalties too low could threaten the entire health overhaul effort. So does MIT economist Jonathan Gruber. He sits on the board that oversees Massachusetts' mandated insurance plan and has been advising the Obama administration.
Think about the political dynamic. It's the end of 2013.
Which is the first year the mandate takes effect.
Since there's no mandate penalty, only the sick have signed up for the exchange. The exchange premium as a result is very high. Politicians say, how can we possibly mandate people to buy insurance when it's this expensive? And the whole law gets killed.
The exchange is the marketplace where individuals and small businesses will go to buy coverage. Gruber says there's already plenty of evidence that you can't require insurers to accept sick people without also requiring everyone to buy coverage. Five states have already tried it.
And they are now five of the eight most expensive places in the country to buy non-group insurance.
So how do you fix the problem? One way would be for the committee to increase the subsidies to help people pay their premiums, says Jacob Hacker, a political science professor at Yale.
But they don't feel that they can come up with the amount of money needed to make coverage affordable for the middle class.
At least not without going over their budget limit of $900 billion. So Hacker has another proposal.
Provide an affordable insurance option, a public insurance plan. The Congressional Budget Office says it'd be about 10% less expensive for consumers than would a private insurance plan. And that means that you don't have to spend as much on subsidies to make sure that people have affordable coverage. And ultimately, that's what we're trying to do.
Now, a public plan competitor is about the last thing the insurance industry wants as a solution to the problem of penalties for the insurance mandate being too small. But it demonstrates yet again the delicate balancing act lawmakers face as they try to find both the right political and policy pieces to make the health overhaul puzzle fit together. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.